that I only type for you in the middle of the show.
So all of these arguments and bickering that we have, Roger, get edited out. But we're our background is briefly. We've all known each other since university, where we all studied physics together.
We should all be on the same page then, and you'll understand what I'm saying very easily.
You would think, Roger. Yeah.
Yeah, it goes out.
Fine.
All right. Well, it's spot on at 1 o'clock here, so 9 o'clock there, so let's get started. Welcome, everyone, to season 2, episode 6, where for a change, we have a special surprise for everyone. Special guest with us. Finally, someone accepted our invitation to come on the show. We are so grateful. I'd like to introduce Roger Sanders, renowned for amplifiers and speakers, and a whole bunch of other stuff that we're going to cover with him today. Welcome to Roger. Roger, would you like to say why you came onto the show?
Because you asked me to, and I'm happy to talk with Audiophiles about audio equipment.
That's fantastic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get started?
Brief, because it's a long story, but I started back in audio with my father back in the 1950s, building Heath kits and building speakers. When I got into university in the 60s, I got into recording, was eventually trained to run the recording studio at the university's concert hall. And I also did a lot of work with them in their audiovisual repair department, where I learned to all the electronic stuff regarding audio and a good deal of video as well. I also heard a lot of different speakers, also install speakers and work with speakers in the concert hall, because at the time we had severely restricted power amplifiers of only about 40 watts per channel. And we had to fill a concert hall with deep, powerful bass. We were building 30-foot horn speakers, 2 stories tall, with double 15-inch drivers in them, that sort of thing. They produced high efficiency. So had a lot of experience with that. One day, a friend of mine took me to hear a pair of KLH-9 electrostatics, which was a total revolution for my life, because I'd never heard anything with the kind of clarity and detail that electrostats could produce. And at that moment was a change in my life. I decided that I was going to spend my future life developing really good loudspeakers. And I have done exactly that, spent the last 44 years developing electrostatic loudspeakers. My work, although it was sort of a hobby, a do-it-yourselfer, word started to get around. People would hear my stuff. And I eventually got requests from magazines to publish a lot of my works. Generated a lot of interest from various speaker manufacturers who wanted to hire me. Started working as a chief engineer at Intersound, developing their electrostatic loudspeakers. That led into other developments, particularly in amplifiers, because there just simply were no amplifiers that we found that were satisfactory for driving extraordinarily difficult loads of electrostatic speakers. So developed the electrostatic amplifier. Intersound was eventually sold, and I started my own business. Standard Sound System is about 2007, and started with amplifiers at that point, electrostatic amplifiers particularly. And then due to popular demand, I went into producing electrostatic loudspeakers again, and additional amplifiers and preamps to go with them. And we have since been basically doubling our sales every year since, and we're a very successful company now. Anyway, so I am semi-retired. My assistant has now mostly taken over the company. He runs it on a daily basis. My business will continue. We'll continue to support our customers into the next 40 or 50 years, since my assistant is only 27 years old. So future looks very promising.
That's an amazing story, I have to say. We're going to touch upon some of those elements, Roger, today. So be prepared for a little bit more questioning. But we're going to take a pause for a second. And we're just going to ask you, and we'll contribute a little bit as well. Over the last, in our case, week, but in your case, what music are you listening to at the moment?
I have a very eclectic taste in music. My main love of music is classical. I'm also a classical musician. I've played in symphony orchestras and jazz in college and so on. So I'm a musician, but it's hard to continue your musician activities when you have family and a career and responsibilities. So I've gone mostly to, one of the reasons I like high-end audio is because I can get the sound I hear in an orchestra, you know, when I'm in the orchestra. And you don't get much opportunity to do that in real life most of the time. So anyway, classical is my favorite, but I like all kinds of music. You name it, I like it, with the occasional exception. I'm not much into rap, and a lot of the pop music today I don't find very entertaining, but...
Completely reasonable, I think.
What instrument do you play, Roger?
Yeah.
I play guitar, I play bass clarinet in the symphony, I play tenor sax and big band jazz. I also play some flute, and believe it or not, I play the accordion.
Hey, that is a beautiful instrument, the accordion. It's vastly underrated, seriously. I used to learn the accordion, so...
Really? That's something you've never told us?
I was the outcast. It was an intro to piano, basically, at the time.
It's underrated for a reason.
All right. My parents had me start in the accordion, and it was a very good education to get started in music.
Yeah, that's right. I found that too when I was young. Trevor, what kind of music have you been listening to over the last couple of weeks?
I've actually been listening to some 20th century classical in the last week or so, just to be a bit highbrow. So here there's a Norwegian composer called Kim Andre Arneson. He's done a beautiful piece that was written in 2016 called Magnificat, and it's a lovely choral piece. And then also listening to Henryk Goreszki, Polish composer. Cool. Symphony number 3, I think, is his most famous, which is Symphony Classic. Of Sorrowful Songs.
I cry every time I hear that. Seriously.
Which it's just so beautiful and, you know, really, really heartrending, but amazing. So, yeah, that's what I've been listening to.
You've just turned into John, seriously, for the last time. All right, Johnny, what have you been listening to and why?
Okay, you're gonna love this. I have gone back to listening to Music Anuda. So for Pete,
are you testing your system again?
No.
Please continue, Johnny. Sorry.
So Music Anuda, they're an Italian pop, jazzy sort of duo. A singer, she's a vocalist, and he's a bass player. Amazing. They do great covers like, you know, Come Together, Roxanne, Message in a Bottle. It sounds like an unlikely combination of bass and a singer. It works fantastically. They're both very talented. She has the most amazing voice.
We should have some Aussie rappers for Roger to recommend. Perhaps not.
I don't know any.
Beastie Boys, right? Aren't they Aussie?
No.
I'm just guessing.
I'm open to anything.
What about you?
What have I been listening to? I have been listening to a whole bunch of female artists, actually, strangely enough.
It's weird.
I know, right? It's going through my... So I started off with Sarah McLachlan, revisiting her Fumbling Towards Ecstasy album. There's a few tracks on that just take me straight back to the 1980s. Then there's an artist I discovered recently called Meg Myers. Her Make a Shadow album in particular is just this sort of rock, folk, a bit of Lord. It's just a weird sort of album, but she's a bit of a revelation for me at the moment. I've listened
she's
to about
pretty
three.
Angry.
She's an angry but very talented and expressive, not normal person. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. She's just very authentic and very individual. So I'm really enjoying Meg Myers. And why? Because it resonates so much at the moment. And you know how much I love listening to female artists on Valves. There, I said it. Okay, yeah. Let's move on.
I'd never have believed that of you.
No.
Of unbelievable.
So
Aris has just revealed that he has a Valve amp and is in love with it. So
I have a few amps, Trevor, and we'll talk about them if the time permits. But... Let's move on, shall we? All right, Roger, your journey seems to have started with speakers, that pivotal moment in your history where you realized that that's what you wanted to do. But strangely enough, you went into amplifier design first. What was it? Was it amplifier because there wasn't anything around to create the sound you were looking for, or was it something that you were interested in by default?
Actually, the first amplifier I actually designed and built was a direct-coupled high-voltage valve amplifier for driving electrostatic speakers directly without any transformers. And that I published in 1976, I believe, in the Audio Amateur magazine. In fact, you can still find that article. All my old articles are on our website. I learned a lot from that, one thing being that's not the best way to drive electrostatic speakers, but it was a pure Class A valve amp, direct-coupled. It sounds, you know, in theory, should have been the best amplifier possible for those speakers, but it turns out to be much more practical to use conventional amplifiers with transformers.
So, sorry to interrupt, but direct coupled amplifiers, my understanding of them is that they have an extraordinarily high voltage that gets sent to the panels.
My amp operated at 2.2 kV, which actually wasn't enough. one of the problems is you need about 10 kV to really drive electrostats well.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster, that much voltage.
It's a recipe for very dangerous amplifier, that's for sure. Anyway, that's one of the reasons I don't use direct coupled amplifiers now, because it's much easier to get the voltage out of a transformer and much safer. I didn't make any more amplifiers at that period of my life. I worked more on the speakers from there on. And it wasn't until 1999, I believe, that we developed an amplifier, a conventional type amplifier with to drive a transformer and electrostatic speaker. And that was the electrostatic amplifier produced by Intersound. And that was our first amplifier product on the market. That amp became so popular among especially MagnaPan owners. So that led me to develop what's called the MagTech amplifier on our product list today. And the MagTech is unique because it's very powerful, but it's the only high-powered audiophile amplifier that uses a fully regulated power supply. And that's really needed for especially high current demanding speakers like Maggie's, because, well, forgetting the technical details, when you start pulling a lot of power out of an amplifier, you drag down its power supply voltage, typically by about 30%. That's a huge amount. The power of the amp is a function of the square of the voltage. So when you drop the voltage by 30%, you drop the power by over 50%. And this is a huge problem in amplifiers. Furthermore, as you change the voltage by the music demands being made on it, this also modulates the distortion in the amplifier, since you can only design the amplifier's electronics to have its lowest distortion at one voltage, you know, the optimum voltage for the design. You've got all this fluctuation of power supply voltage is modulating the distortion of the amplifier. And as if that isn't bad enough, the other thing is the bias. As you change the voltage, the bias changes. So you've got the music basically modulating the power, the distortion, and the bias in a conventional amplifier with a free-floating power supply. And that just was really wrecking the performance of amplifiers when you're trying to drive really power-hungry speakers like Maggie's. So why aren't all amplifiers voltage regulated? And the answer is conventional regulators are just so inefficient, there's huge amounts of waste heat developed in them. If you got a 2,000 watt amplifier and you're wasting half of it as heat, now you can't deal with that. So you just don't find amplifiers in the market today with regulated power supplies. So I had to invent a new kind of regulated power supply that ran cold. Anyway, that became the MagTech amplifier. I added that to the electrostatic amplifier, and by the way, the thing that was special about the electrostatic amplifier is that it was able to drive extremely difficult loads, highly reactive loads, very low impedance loads. And to do that, we had to make it drive a 1/3 ohm load without blowing up, and do that without any protective circuitry, because protective circuitry is one of the main things that ruins the sound of amplifiers. Most solid state amplifiers use protective circuitry that when it's triggered, and it's triggered a lot, it really messes up the sound. And if you look at what's coming down out of the amplifier on an oscilloscope while it's triggering its protective circuitry, it's awful and it sounds bad. And that's the harsh, irritating so-called transistor sound that audiophiles talk about.
Hold on, that really means for me that valve amps sound better than transistor amps. Is that right? How does that work?
Oh, here we go.
That is just ridiculous. You know that's rubbish, Harris. You know,
it's great.
Isn't really transistor sound. Transistors don't have any particular sound. It is the protection of a protective circuitry in action that causes that irritating sound quality of a overloaded and clipping solid state amplifier. And one of the reasons a lot of audiophiles like valves is because they don't have any protective circuitry. Now, that doesn't mean they sound good when they're clipping. No amplifier sounds good when it's clipping. The distortion's high, because dynamics are compressed, it sounds strained, it loses its detail. So no clipping amplifier is really any good. But if you have to pick between a clipping solid state amp and a clipping tube amp, most audiophiles, and I include myself with that, would rather listen to clipping tubes than clipping solid state. But of course, my philosophy is clipping in all cases is terrible. So I don't make low power amplifiers that clip. You know, the MagTech does 500 watts per channel into 8 ohms and 900 watts into 4 ohms. And that's the two channel version. The monoblock does over 2000 watts.
So Roger, you're saying we need a kilowatt. That's more than my kettle uses just to produce music.
Two kettles.
With special cords.
With kettle cords.
That's what's required to have clean sound. And one of the things I don't understand with audiophiles is why they're using 100-watt amplifiers. They're just guaranteed bad performance. It takes 500 to 1,000 watts per channel to operate a loudspeaker. That's not my opinion. That's something that's easily measured. Just put an oscilloscope on your speakers and start playing them and watch what happens. You know, when you get to the level where your amplifier is clipping, you'll see the trace look like somebody took scissors and clipped the top off of it. That's where the term clipping comes from.
I've got an anecdote with that, if I can jump in. So prior to my purchase of my first Magtech, I used to own a pair of Zingali speakers, which are an Italian horn, backloaded horn design, which are nominally 95 dB rated. And I was running them with a 50 watt power amp, which according to most people should be absolutely plenty. And I did exactly that. I put an oscilloscope across the terminals and I saw that brick wall happening. And it was kind of shocking. And I think most audiophiles probably think that 100 watts or 150 watts is plenty.
You've got to use 500 watts or more, unless you have horns. But unfortunately, most of the audiophile horns speakers, they're only mid-range and tweeter horns. The bass is not a horn, usually. A friend of mine built two 30-foot horns made out of concrete, one in his front yard, one in his backyard, and he brought them in as the walls of his basement. And that was really good bass. It was really good bass. So were the big horn speakers we put in the concert hall at the university, but they're not practical for home use. You know, 90% of the energy in music lies below 200 hertz. So most of the power you need for your system is going to be driving the woofer. If you don't have a horn woofer, then, you know, your horn speakers, even though the mid-range tweeters are really efficient, the woofer is conventional and it's only going to be about 1% efficient, and it's going to take 500 to 1,000 watts to drive it if you don't want your system to be clipping. Again, this isn't magic. It's not rocket science. Just measure it and look. But audiophiles don't measure things, and it's really too bad because they instead listen to all the BS that you hear out there and never really learn the truth. Also, remember that music is highly dynamic. The average level may only require a few watts, but the peak level is going to require at least 10 times that. So if your average level, and I've measured plenty of speakers, typical cone speakers with around 90 dB mm-hmm. sensitivity, and you'll find that they need around 30 to 50 watts average level. And so 100 watt amp will drive them without obvious distortion because it's not clipping. But the peaks, which are occurring constantly, but are only a very small percentage of the music, they're going to require, instead of 30 to 50 watts, they're going to take 300 to 500 watts to reproduce the musical peaks. And that's where the problem is, because you don't recognize peak clipping because it's so short. What you do recognize is that it doesn't sound quite right. It tends to sound harsh. It tends to be compressed. You get this sensation of pressure in your ears. There's an irritation, a listening fatigue associated with it. These are the signs of peak clipping that you normally don't recognize as just clipping for what it is. Most audiophiles think it's got something to do with some feature of the amp, like say it's whether it uses tubes or transistors, or it's class A or class AB, or whether it's got feedback or not. And in fact, those things really don't have anything to do with it. It's just simple clipping. If you measure it, you'll see that's true. And if you use an amplifier with enough power that it doesn't clip, all those unpleasant sensations amazingly just disappear.
Roger, they're really interesting points that you make. Just looking at the sort of the amplifier market that we observe, there's, you know, equipment like yours, which is high powered and obviously doesn't have those clipping issues, but there seems to be a whole universe of manufacturers which make lower powered stuff of strange configurations, etc. I guess this is a marketing question. Do you think they're positioning themselves as a different sort of amplifier experience, or is it they've developed a magic sauce that somehow sounds terrific? What explains all that, the difference of amplifier design?
You'd have to ask them, because from my perspective, it doesn't make any sense to make or sell an amplifier that produces less than 500 watts per channel, because it's going to sound badly. There's no point in it. But of course, the audio industry is full of snake oil salesmen who will sell you almost anything, worthless or not, just to make a buck. For an amplifier to sound perfect, it has to achieve three basic criteria. Number one, it has to have inaudible distortion. I'm sure we'd all agree, a distorting amplifier sounds terrible. And so what does that mean? That means it's got to have less than 1% distortion, because humans can't hear less than 1% distortion. That's why valve amps sound okay to people, because although valves tend to have a lot of distortion, typically up around 1%, they still sound clean to a human ear. Number two is inaudible noise. In the case of amplifiers, that's usually very easy to achieve. You got to have a signal-to-noise ratio of somewhere around 90 dB or so, and usually humans cannot then hear any noise. You go up and put your ear right in the speaker, and you don't hear anything. Of course, the typical high-power solid-state amp is going to have a signal-to-noise ratio much better than that. Ours do about 124 dB, so they are totally silent. So the noise criteria is easy to meet. The third thing is linear frequency response. Got to have linear frequency response, or it's going to change the sound. And when it comes to high fidelity sound, the gold standard is the amplifier should simply reproduce what's there, not change it in any way. And if you change the frequency response, it's like, you know, turning up the bass or treble on an old receiver. It's going to change the sound. Well, that's not the purpose of an amplifier. The purpose is to simply add power to the original signal without altering the signal in any other way. The big problem in today's market is the Class D amplifier, the switch mode amplifiers. They inherently do not have linear high frequency response. You've got to tailor them to your load to produce linear frequency response. The manufacturers of these amps try to make them have reasonably linear high frequency response. So I don't consider switch mode amps to be high quality or high fidelity amplifiers, with one exception. They're nice for woofers because you don't have any high frequencies to deal with.
I think I'm going to cry quietly there, Roger. I've got a Class D amplifier, or several of them.
Roger has just nailed the coffin shut on your Class D, Johnny.
But you know, you got to be fair about this. Audiophiles do not necessarily like linear sound. One of the things that everybody should be using and is absolutely essential if you want really linear frequency response from your system, you've got to use a room correction system. It's terribly important. No matter how good you say your speaker is, if it doesn't have a loudspeaker management system, it could be better. And all the pros are using them now. Audiophiles are just way behind the time.
I think you find some kindred spirits here. We've definitely covered room correction, and our journeys have shown exactly what you've articulated, is that if we don't include room correction in some way, shape, or form, we've realized that we're living with substandard sound. I wanted to touch upon a topic which is very dear to all our hearts, where, you know, you mentioned testing. And in a couple of episodes recently, we've touched upon the sort of difference between a subjectivist versus objectivist. Somebody who uses measurements and science to determine quality versus someone who listens and convinces themselves that something is good enough. And there's that cross section where you said audible distortion, where I think there's an interesting sort of overlap between what people think they hear versus what the measurements say and where you cross that boundary. But how important is testing, objective testing, or even subjective testing in general, to producing a great loudspeaker or amplifier?
So one of the, if I can jump in here, one of the, I guess the areas that subjectivists and objectivists seem to often disagree on is that subjectivists say that you say all amps sound the same. And what you're saying is that in fact, not all amps sound the same because the way they clip is different. So in some ways, both the objectivists and the subjectivists are correct. It's just that they're talking about different conditions. Listening to two amps that are well behaved according to your criteria and are not clipping, there should be no discernible difference. Is that correct?
Let me be very specific though before I get into some general terms. Let's talk about amplifiers and what audiophiles hear when they test amplifiers subjectively versus what's measured and why the two don't seem to jive. And I think we would agree that most audiophiles will say, well, the measurements don't really tell me what this amplifier is going to sound like. I got to listen to it. And actually, they're both wrong and they're right. And the reason for that is because most audiophiles are using underpowered amplifiers that are clipping all the time. But you don't measure an amplifier when it's clipping because it has horrible performance and there's no point in it. So when we measure an amplifier, we always measure it when it's operating within its design parameters. And in that case, measurements are far more accurate than the human ear and will tell you exactly how the amplifier is going to sound. But audiophiles don't listen to their amplifiers like that. They're operating them in their clipping modes. And amplifiers behave very differently when they clip. A good example, as I just already mentioned, is that valves don't use protective circuitry. Transistors do, and when you're clipping an amp, its protective circuitry is going nuts. And so they definitely sound different. And that's why audiophiles don't see a correlation between what the measurements are and what they're hearing. But if they did their subjective listening tests in a valid manner, where they controlled these variables such as clipping, and they adjusted the levels of their system so they did not have any clipping, then the measurements that they get and what they hear would be the same, or would correlate.
Roger, your opinion, your philosophy really appeals to me. It's sort of the way I like to think about it. But do you find it frustrating that there's, in the world of audiophiles, there seems to be a whole lot of mysticism involved, and therefore you know, different ways of appealing to people? Does that change the way you market your equipment, or does it frustrate you?
I find it absolutely devastating that the state of the high-end audio industry has come to this. I think it's horrible, and it's horrible because people, again, most of the audiophiles I find are sincere and trying to get really good sound, and they're totally befuddled by all this BS they're hearing out in the audiophile world. And when I can give them factual information and prove it to them, they're very appreciative. And by the way, even though most of what I'm saying flies in the face of what most audiophiles believe, it turns out to be a very good selling tool. Once people learn what's really going on as we explain it to them, they buy our stuff and they recognize it's really good, and they support us, and we have a wonderful reputation in the industry. I don't care if some audiophiles don't like me or don't believe what I'm saying, because I'm able to help others really get great sound. And that's what appeals to me. I'm trying to bring the joy of beautiful music into the home of as many people as possible. To do that, throughout my life, I've had to build better equipment, and I've had to explain to people what's going on and why we make such good stuff.
Roger, I have to say it's been a pleasure listening to you personally, and also finding out a bit about Saunders Sound Systems.
Hang on, Aris. I'm supposed to be the Saunders fanboy here. That's enough from you.
Hey, look, I was just happy for someone to come onto our show. Seriously.
Yeah,
Roger,
it's been
thank
great.
Thank you so much. Yeah, fantastic.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Just say Roger, Roger, and then we're done.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Roger. Really appreciate it.
Roger. Roger, Roger. Over, over.
See you next
bye.
Time.
See you next week.
Thank you.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Pretty much everything.
So that's it.
He'll never come back again.